Okay, so welcome back again. We're going to continue on looking at the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, Sammaditti. And now we're going to look at those two factors that are perhaps the most surprising to find in the Sammaditti part. The one about the fact that there is mother and father, and by implication that the karma that we can make in relation to mother and father is very strong, either positive or negative, and also the idea that generosity is part of the Noble Eightfold Path, the right view. So first of all, let's have a look at there is mother and father, and see, there's a couple of short suttas, what the Buddha says about mother and father elsewhere, just to get some idea about how we should regard this and what we can do in relation to our parents. The first one is from the Anguttara Nikaya 2, and it goes as follows. Bhikkhus, there are two persons that cannot easily be repaid. What two? One's mother and father. Even if one should carry about one's mother on one shoulder and one's father on the other, and while doing so should have a lifespan of 100 years, live for 100 years, and if one should attend to them by anointing them with balms, by massaging, bathing, and rubbing their limbs, and they even void their urine and excrement right there, one still would not have done enough for one's parents, nor one would one have repaid them. Even if one were to establish one's parents as the supreme lords and rulers over this great earth, abounding in the seven treasures, one still would not have done enough for one's parents, nor would one have repaid them. For what reason? Parents are of great help to their children. They bring them up, feed them, and show them the world. But because if, when one's parents lack faith, one encourages, settles, and establishes them in faith, if when one's parents are immoral, one encourages, settles, and establishes them in virtuous behavior, if when one's parents are miserly, one encourages, settles, and establishes them in generosity, if when one's parents are unwise, one encourages, settles, and establishes them in wisdom, in such a way, one has done enough for one's parents, repaid them, and done more than enough for them. So this is just a short sutta, which just gives a little bit of, is fairly simple and fairly straightforward. But the idea is that it is very difficult to repay one's parents, because they have done so much for one. And I think it's very useful to reflect on that fact, what one's parents actually have done. Because if you have a grasp, a feeling for that, the more a feeling for that you have, the more sense of gratitude you have to your parents. And sometimes you need to deliberately reflect on these things to actually be able to establish that sense of gratitude and thankfulness. And what he's saying specifically here, I think this is kind of the crucial, perhaps one of the crucial bits in the sutta, is that your parents, they bring you up, they feed you, and you show them the world, right? In other words, without your parents, without them looking after you, without all these things, there's so many years when we are completely helpless. You know, from the moment you are born until you reach maybe almost adolescence, you are completely dependent on your parents. And if your parents weren't there, you wouldn't basically survive, right? You wouldn't live. You would die. So you owe your very life in a very real sense to your parents. And not only that, but our ability to function in the world, our ability to run our lives as mature people also depends to a large extent what our parents have taught us. From the very beginning, our parents have taught us all the basics in life, right? The basics of how to eat properly, how to dress, how to tie our shoelaces, how to go to the toilet, how to clean ourselves. Then how to speak properly, right? How to do the basic kind of counting and maths in life. There is so much that our parents have taught us. All the basic things basically comes from our parents. And without them, we wouldn't know anything. And this is important to remember, because our relationship with our family and with our parents is often very complicated. When you are so close to somebody, there's bound to be times when there are problems, right? There's bound to be times when there are arguments. There's bound to be times when we complain about each other. That's the nature of living very closely together. That is what happens. So because of that, it's very easy to remember all the difficult times, right? Sometimes, especially with parents, especially with people who are close to us, it is important that we make a deliberate effort to remember all the good things, to remind ourselves that without our parents, we just wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be able to survive, essentially. And when you do that, you can gradually change your perception of your parent. Instead of complaining about them, instead of saying that your parents are the source of all your problems in life, right, which sometimes happens, instead of seeing that, you actually realize that a lot of your happiness and your ability to function in life is due to your parents. And then you get this feeling that you have a debt of gratitude. You have a debt to your parents. So how, and then once you feel a little bit a sense of debt, of that thankfulness, it makes it so much easier to treat your parents in the right way. It is very hard if you feel that you feel on the one hand that you're a Buddhist, I should treat my parents right, but then you don't really have that feeling inside, that sense of gratitude. It makes it very difficult. It's like two things clashing with each other. But if you are able to turn your mind in the right direction, so you can actually see the goodness there, it makes it so much easier to fulfill your obligation to your parents. Makes it so much easier to be kind to them. Makes it so much easier to help them and support them in their old age and all these kind of things. So this is what the purpose of this is, to turn your mind in the right direction, to make it easier, not to make it feel as a burden when you support your parents, but make it feel even joyful, right? If it is joyful, it becomes very supportive for the practice of the Buddhist path, because then it becomes an element as part of your meditation practice. This is sort of what I have tried to do in relationship to my parents. In the beginning, when I went back to my parents to visit them after being a young monk, when you're a young monk, you always think that you have to convert everybody else, right? Get the whole world sorted out, and including your parents, of course. But if you try as a young monk to convert your parents, they will resist. They will not listen to you. They will not be interested in what you have to say. It's a bit different in Sri Lanka, because your parents are quite likely to be Buddhist already. But when you come from a place where I come from, then your parents are have a very different idea of things. So the first thing, and you learn that very quickly, don't try to convert your parents. Let it be. And it is always action that speaks much louder than words, right? So what I understood very early on is that what I have to do is just to do the right thing, right? To act, to show that I'm actually not just a Buddhist intellectually or through ideas, but I actually am a Buddhist through practice. And that is what, after a while, when your parents see that you're actually doing the right thing, and not only just for a short while, but year after year after year, then eventually something starts to happen inside of them, and their eyes kind of start to open up that there must be something profound going on. You know, before I was a Buddhist monk, I was kind of the typical bad teenager, right, always rebellious, doing the bad kind of things. But suddenly they can see a change. You're doing something else. You actually not just are you neutral, but you're actually doing positive things. And that really goes to your parents' heart when they see that. Parents are always very close to their children, and it's very nice for them when they see that, you know, there is some kind of response coming back in this way. I have very good parents, but what happened after a while was that they started to come to me and they started to ask me, you know, teach us some meditation, you know, what books on Buddhism should we be reading, and they started to become interested in Buddhism, that was very very fascinating. It's when you don't try to teach them, that is when they become interested. That is what happened to me. And these days, they go onto YouTube, but just like people here, and they listen to Dhamma talks from the BSWA in Australia. They even listen to my talks, even though I'm the son, right? The father listens to his son's talks. Now that is quite astonishing. That is actually what happened in my case. So I was very pleased with that and very happy, because this next part of the sutta is precisely that the way to repay is to encourage your parents in the Dhamma to do the right thing here. That you settle them, they become more wise, more moral, more generous. And the way to do that is always by example. And I think in the long run, the example will tend to win, and then that interest will come from your parents, and then you will be able to repay them according to this sutta. So, that's a please try to think in this way. Also remember, I think one of the reasons why when we are young, we expect too much of our parents. We think our parents are supposed to be perfect, always do the right thing. But always we need to remind ourselves that our parents are ordinary people, just like everybody else. They are subject to their own conditioning, to their own defilements, to their own problems. They have their own suffering in life. They're not going to be perfect. And once we realize that, once we understand that they are no better than anybody else, it makes it easy for us to forget them. But despite their defects, despite their problems, despite the things they had in their life, still they have been able to look after us with enormous metta and kindness for all those years. So that is the first little sutta, just to kind of, and this of course goes for monastics, lay people alike. Maybe I should say a couple of words before I go on to the next one about what if your parents are dead? Can you still do anything for your parents? And the answer is, according to the Buddhist teaching, you can. And one of the things that we do in Buddhism, and we're talking about this the other day, is to dedicate merit to your parents. You do an act of kindness, and when you do an act of kindness and you dedicate that to your departed parents, according to Buddhism, there's one way that they can actually share in that dedication. They can feel what you're doing, understand what you're doing, and experience a sense of happiness because of that. So please do that whenever you have a chance, whenever you do an act of kindness, and we can do that as monastics as well. Everybody can do that. Dedicate it to your parents. And there is this sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya Tens. I think it's called the Janusoni Sutta, or certainly spoken to Janusoni. And with the Buddha, Janusoni, he's a high caste, he's a Brahmin at the time of the Buddha. He goes to the Buddha and says, can anybody take part or share in this merit that I dedicate to my parents or to whoever? And the Buddha says, yes, if they are reborn in a certain realm, they can take part, they can share this merit. Or they can share in the dedication or whatever. Make sure you get my terminology right here. And then the Brahmin says, well, what if my parents are not reborn in that particular realm? Well, there will be other of your relatives that are reborn in that realm. And then he says, but what if I haven't got any relatives in that realm? And then the Buddha says, it is inconceivable, it is impossible that throughout this long course of birth and death, you should not have a single relative in that realm. So in other words, the bonds of family, it goes on for a long, long time. And even if this is about many, many lifetimes ago, there will be people there who will be able to share or to enjoy the dedication of merit that you do for them. This is one of the great things that we do as Buddhists. People who die in other religions, they don't have that great fortune of having people who can dedicate merit for them, but we have that in Buddhism. So please, let us try to make use of that. So that is the first thing that we can do if our parents have already passed away. Another thing that we can do is also remember that if they can experience the dedication of merit that you make, it means that there is also a channel of communication is open there, right? There is some communication possible, otherwise they wouldn't be able to experience the fact that you dedicate merit to them. So when you do metta meditation, you can include your parents even if they are departed. Or you can do like forgiveness, you can ask forgiveness of your parents. You can say to them, I know that you passed, because often there's perhaps lingering things if they pass away suddenly or whatever. You can say to them, please forgive me for any weaknesses. I too forgive you for any problems in the past. And if the communication channel is there, if they are reborn in the right realm, they may be able to feel those things as well. These are little things that we can do, even if our parents have passed away here. It's a wonderful thing that we can communicate sometimes, even though people are no longer here. So, this is that particular sutta. One more short sutta on parents. This is another very nice sutta, which kind of catches your eye when you read the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's called Brahma. And it goes as follows. Bhikkhus, those families dwell with Brahma, where at home the mother and father are revered by their children. Those families dwell with the first teachers, where at home the mother and father are revered by their children. Those families dwell with the gift-worthy, where at home the mother and father are revered by their children. Brahma, because, is a designation. It's a term for mother and father. First teachers is a designation for mother and father. Gift-worthy is a designation for mother and father. For what reason? Mother and father are helpful to their children. They raise them, nurture them, and show them the world. So again, this is a way of thinking about your parents, right? To reflect in such a way that we actually give rise to this feeling of understanding, of gratitude, even of compassion towards our parents. And the first one is this idea that you are dwelling with Brahma, right? Your parents are like Brahma. This is a designation for the parents. So what is the characteristic of Brahma? The characteristic of Brahma is that Brahma is one of the, you know, the highest kind of devas in this world, in the Brahma Loka. The Brahma is the, being reborn there is the outcome of the practice of the Brahma Viharas mainly, right? So it basically means they are metta, they are compassion, they are kindness towards their children. That is what this means. So you remember that your parents have this endless, essentially, metta, patience, endurance, right, with children. And this is one of those remarkable things about parents, where other people would have given up on you a long time ago. Your parents always have that patience, always have that kindness, always have time to listen to you. Even if you do really bad things in the world, you become a criminal, you become you do all kind of bad things, but you come back to your mother, and chances are she will take you back in again. Why is that possible? How can your parents have so much metta where the rest of the world does not have that metta? What is going on? And the reason is because your parents are always able to see the goodness in you. We are all very composite beings. We have bad aspects. We have good aspects. The parents are always able to see the good aspect. Your mother, she remembers you from you were a little, sweet little child, right? All the way growing up. And she has seen all the good parts of you throughout all those years. And because she always remembers that, she will always take you back. Because she knows there is an aspect in you which is good. And this is a very useful thing. To think like that, because this is everybody has a mother, right? Because everybody has a mother, everybody is loved by somebody. It means that everybody is lovable. It's possible to be kind and to have metta towards everybody. We need to think of ourselves as a mother. And when you are a mother, you always see the goodness in the people around you. This is a very powerful way of helping us in this idea of metta, looking for the good in other people. It is always there. Sometimes it is a bit hidden, but it is under the surface. And there is actually a sutta later on which talks about how to do that in more detail. But it's very useful just to reflect, what does it feel like to be a mother? And to remember the mother's ability to always forgive, always have metta, regardless of how the child is. Perhaps not 100% regardless, but, you know, mother can go a long, long way before she turns away from her child. So this is the first one. Remember this metta that your parents have. Remember that it's difficult to be a parent. Nobody else in the whole world would look after you in the same way as a parent, right? It's because they are your parents that they look after you in the way they do. This is the first one. The second one is that your parents are your first teachers, right? And of course, in the world, we tend to respect a teacher. This is what having a teacher is all about. Why do we respect a teacher? Because a teacher, they reveal to us things that we otherwise wouldn't know. When you go to school, a teacher teaches you things to make you, enable you to work and function in the world, to be able to later on give you a livelihood and to have work, right? In a spiritual life, we all have teachers. In the end, the Buddha is our final teacher, and that's why we respect the Buddha so enormously, because he has the key. He has the crucial thing to make us understand happiness and suffering. The most core thing that we all are yearning for deep down, happiness, understanding how to be happy, understanding how to avoid suffering. The Buddha has the key to that. So it's like the highest teacher, the teacher who has kind of the key to the secret of life itself. And that is why we revere the Buddha so highly. But your parents are also teachers. And in a very real way, as we said before, your parents give you your ability to live your life and to function in the world. And for this reason, they are your first teachers, and for this reason, they too respect to be, they deserve to be revered in the same way. So these are beautiful ways of thinking about parents, right? When you think about your parents this way, it changes your perspective, it changes your perception of what is going on. And then the last one, they are gift worthy, right? Your parents are gift worthy. Now, this dakineya is the Pali word, dakineya, gift-worthy. Now, who are usually the people who are gift-worthy according to Buddhism? Usually the gift-worthy ones are the Aryas, right? The Aryas, one of the characteristics of the Arya Sangha, it's dakineya, it's gift-worthy. So the Aryas are gift-worthy, including the Arahants, the people who are kind of the very pinnacle of human existence, at the very top of the kind of the what is possible to make out of our human existence. These are the ones that are normal called dakineya. And here the parents are put on the same level. Right? The same level as the Aryas. Again, very, very powerful. And so again, it means that there's something very, very important going on here. So remember these things. And all of these things, what they amount to, and I think one of the important aspects for the spiritual path here is that it means that the kind of karma we can do in relationship to our parents is very strong. We can either make very good karma with our parents by doing the right thing, or if we are silly, if we miss the point, then we can also make a lot of very bad karma with our parents. And if we do it the right way, this becomes a very powerful support for the practice of the spiritual path. Now, I know that usually when I say these things, there's always a few people in a large group of people who had a very difficult life, had a difficult upbringing, maybe had difficult parents. There's always some people who have that. This is everywhere, in all cultures across the world. And they often come to me and say to me, but, you know, what am I supposed to do? I had this incredibly... My parents were so tough, and they were so rigid, and sometimes they were abusive, and all these kind of things. How can I have metta? How can I support my parents when I feel, all I feel is just anger after all those years of hardship with my parents? And remember, the point here is not to be able straight away to have lots of metta and compassion to your parents. The point here is just to move a little bit in the right direction. So if you have a lot of anger towards your parents because they haven't treated you properly, your job is not to go straight to metta. Your job is to try to be a little bit less angry by seeing the positive as well as seeing the negative. Right? This is the point here. We try to move a little bit in the right direction. We try to forgive. We try to understand that our parents too were subject to cause and conditions that made them who they were. They probably wanted to love you. They may even have thought they did love you. But as a matter of fact, they actually mistreated you instead. So once you understand this about your parents, that they probably did their best, but they just didn't have the psychological and inner resources to be able to do that, then forgiveness can start to happen. Anger can start to die down, and gradually you can move in the right direction towards your parents. So it's always about moving in the right direction, not to jump from kind of one side to the other side. And then you are doing what you can. And gradually over time, you may see a shift inside of yourself. Okay, so that is about parents. I think that is probably plenty enough on that topic. And just again, once more to remind you that it is obviously significant that this thing is included in right view on the Noble Eightfold Path. Now I want to move on to generosity. And I will probably go through this reasonably quickly. There's quite a number of suttas here, but they are usually, they're fairly self-explanatory. I don't think I have to say all that much. So let's see what this says about the idea of generosity. And the first one is from the Samyutta Nikaya. This is from the Kosala Samyutta. These are discussions between King Pasenadi of Kosala and the Buddha. And that's actually quite a nice little Samyutta. If you want to have a nice little Samyutta to read for yourself, that is quite a nice one. All these conversations between the king and the Buddha, very practical, quite simple teachings, but simple but profound, right? And for this reason, worth reading, I would say. Not too difficult to understand, and that is one of the benefits of this. Anyway, this is a short extract from one of these discussions between the king and the Buddha. And it goes as follows. At Savati, sitting to one side, King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, where should a gift be given? Wherever one's mind has confidence, great King." It's a very short extract. I didn't know it was quite that short. The sutta is actually quite long, so I've already taken out a tiny, tiny bit. So after that, after he says that, then the next question the Buddha, King Pasenadi, asks is, where is there the most merit, right? Where is there the most good karma to be obtained? And then the Buddha says, well, that is when you give to somebody who is fully awakened, an arahant, right? There's just two things, and I didn't actually speak about this a few days ago, but it might be worthwhile just repeating what I said for those who weren't there. I think that was in Colombo when I spoke about this. And it is quite striking, isn't it, that there is a difference between what is the most merit and where a gift should be given. Why isn't it the case that the gift should be given where there is most merit? Isn't that the natural thing, that where there is most merit, that is where you should give? How come there is a difference between the two? Why is it that the Buddha gives different answers to these two questions? And the reason for that is not actually explained in the sutta. So this is where you have to do a little bit of interpretation and try to understand what is going on. But it seems to me that the idea here, where a gift should be given, where you have confidence, the Pali word is pasidati, is where the mind becomes peaceful, mind becomes calm, where you have confidence, where you feel inspired in something, right? I think one of the main reasons why a gift should be given there is because when you feel inspired in giving, you also feel the power of giving, because you feel happy when you give to a place where you feel inspired, where you feel there is a need, where you feel that compassion has arisen in you, and you feel, wow, this is a nice thing to do. So you feel happy about that. And because you feel happy about that, it actually has quite a large impact on your mind. You feel happy, you have mindfulness, and the karma for that reason is quite strong, because you have that mindfulness and happiness. And also when you do that, it means you learn about giving. You learn about the power of giving. You learn about the joy of giving, right? If you give and you feel joyful about it, you feel a sense of confidence about it, then you learn that giving is a good thing and you want to do it again in the future. But if you start calculating that, you know, I will get so-and-so much merit here, so-and-so much merit there, and you kind of make all the calculations, and then, okay, this is where I'm going to give because this is more merit, it's not the same thing. It's kind of very cold, right? And I've been taught apparently there are some people who think like that. I don't know, here in Sri Lanka, this was another country where I went to, I was told by a monk from that country, said, well, this is how people think in this country. They kind of, you know, sum it all up, and they think this is where it's most merit, so this is what I will give. But there's no joy, there's no happiness, it doesn't work, right? And that is the problem with that kind of calculation. So that's why you learn to give. You learn the happiness of giving, and you learn to move in the right direction by giving where you feel confidence, where you feel inspired, where your heart takes you, right? That is where you give. So remember that, because what that means is that it means that you don't always have to give to Buddhist causes, right? It means you don't have to kind of go around thinking where is the most merit. You just feel inside of yourself, when does it feel good? And that is when you give. Right? I'm not saying that you shouldn't give to Buddhist causes, of course. That would be terrible, right? A Buddhist monk going around saying you shouldn't give to Buddhist causes. Of course, not saying that. I'm just saying that it is important to get that feeling, and then you're heading in the right direction. And when there is most merit, of course, is when you give to the Arahant, or even better is to give to the whole Sangha. That's the best way of giving. But let's say that you give it to an Arahant, that is where there's most merit. And if you keep your eyes open and you feel that somebody is worthy of a gift, especially you see the Sangha and you feel inspired and you give a gift to the Sangha and you feel inspired in that, of course, that is a wonderful thing to do. Then you have given in the right place, and also the merit will also be good according to how the Buddha talks about this. Actually, there's a very important point, this idea in Buddhism of giving to the Sangha rather than giving to individuals. It's a very important thing here. It means that we don't kind of discriminate, we don't try to calculate, we don't try to judge too much, but you give to the whole institution, the whole of Buddhism, this whole thing which keeps the Dhamma alive in the world, right? And then ensures the happiness and the reduction in suffering also for future generations. And then we're doing it in the right way. You have this broad mind, not a narrow mind, but a broad mind that takes everybody into account. So that is the first sutta on where a gift should be given. So please keep that in mind. And yes. Then we have the next sutta. This is from the Tika Nipata in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's called Vacca. Vacca was a wanderer at the time of the Buddha. His name was actually Vacca-gotta, and he was always going to the Buddha, asking the Buddha questions. There's so many suttas with Vacca-gotta. I don't know how many there are, but there's a lot. Maybe 20 or 30 suttas with Vacca-gotta. He appears everywhere and always going to the Buddha, having questions, right? And the Buddha has endless patience with this one fellow, Vacca-gotta. There's three whole suttas just in the Majjhima Nikaya, Vacca-gotta, and he appears in all kind of places. And I wonder whether the Buddha ever got fed up with this person, but I think the Buddha saw the potential, that this person actually had a lot of potential, and eventually he actually ends up becoming Arahant, Vacca-gotta. So the Buddha probably saw that he has a potential, and that's why I'm going to give him, continue teaching him in this way. So this is one of these encounters between Vacca-gotta and the Buddha. And this is what the Buddha, this is a reply to a question that Vacca-gotta has asked the Buddha. Those Vacca who say, the ascetic Gotama says, alms should be given only to me, not to others. Alms should be given only to my disciples, not to the disciples of others. Only what is given to me is very fruitful, not what is given to others. Only what is given to my disciples is very fruitful, not what is given to the disciples of others. The people who say this do not state what has been said by me, but misrepresent me with what is untrue and contrary to fact. And one who prevents another from giving alms creates an obstruction and stumbling block for three people. What three? He creates an obstruction to the donors acquiring merit, to the recipients gaining a gift, and already he has maimed and injured himself. One who prevents another from giving alms creates an obstruction and stumbling block for these three people. But, Vacca, I say that one acquires merit even if one throws away dishwashing water in a refuse dump, or cesspit with the thought, may the living beings here sustain themselves with this. How much more, then, does one acquire merit when one gives to human beings? However, I say that what is given to one of virtuous behavior is more fruitful than what is given to an immoral person. And the most worthy recipient is one who has abandoned five factors and possesses five factors. That is the Arahant, is the last one. Just to make it clear what this means. It is explained further down in the sutta. I took that out because it wasn't so crucial. So this is the Buddha saying, first of all, I don't go around saying that you should just give to me, right? It doesn't sound very nice if you go around and say, you know, only give to me, you know, I am the one who is worthy of gifts. It doesn't sound right, and it would sound very strange if the Buddha actually said that. So, and then the interesting thing that he says here is that if you do say these things, you are creating an obstacle for other people. You're creating an obstacle for the acquiring of merit, for the receiving of the gift, and the important thing here, you are injuring yourself, right? Injuring yourself here means that you are hindering your own spiritual progress. So this idea, and this is one of those interesting things about the Buddhist path again, is this idea that when we, not only do we act in a moral way, but we also encourage other people to act in a moral way. That is part of morality itself. So if we have the opportunity to encourage other people to be generous, to be virtuous and do what is right, that is part of our own morality. So we encourage others and we are moral ourselves. If we discourage others, we are actually creating a stumbling block for ourselves. And remember, generosity is always good. It is always good, no matter where it's given, no matter how defiled the motivation is. If you are giving, it is always good. Giving gifts is always a positive thing. It should always be encouraged. So this is I think an important kind of sub-point of the idea of sila, the idea of encouraging others to do what is right. Then comes this nice little passage about the importance of making merit, and not only the importance, but how easy it actually is to make merit, right? It says here, one acquires merit even if one throws away the dishwashing water in the refuse dump or cesspit, with the idea, may the living beings there live on this. If you think about that, the wonderful thing about that is that there are so many opportunities in life when we can do good. Every time you're washing the dishes, there may be a little few rice grains left over. If you take those rice grains and you throw them outside to the insects, you're making merit, right? It is so easy. For example, here, I try to live by these examples myself because I think it is actually very, very, these are obviously very practical things. So when I wash my bowl after the meal, I have a little bit, few rice grains left over, I throw it outside and I try to remind myself every time to have this kind of intention in mind, right? It's a kind intention of compassion towards these living beings. And once you start to use all the potential, all the possible possibilities of making merit, of doing good karma, it is actually a lot, right? Every time we open our mouth, every time we interact with another person, every time we even sit down and think for ourselves, is actually a potential for making good karma. It is very, very vast when you start thinking in the right way. And when you understand the importance of sila on the path, right? This is one of the reasons why I read that, the first sutta at the beginning, to show that the whole foundation for meditation practice, the whole foundation is sila. When you start to understand how important sila is for the meditation, for the whole path to come into being, then you start taking every opportunity. You start to remind yourself of the urgency. Now is the chance. This very moment, I have to do what is right. You start to take every opportunity to do what is good. And this is what the Buddha says. Actually, there are lots of opportunities in life as long as we are aware and we are alert and we have the sampajanya, the clear comprehension of what is going on. So these little things are, in my opinion, it only occurs in this place in the suttas. I don't think it occurs anywhere else, this little thing. But still, I find them quite powerful when we reflect on these things in the right way. And of course, if you do these things to human beings, of course, the merit is even more. But you open yourself up to all situations, and this is kind of the idea here. So, then we can move on to the next sutta, quite a simple, short little sutta, nonetheless quite nice. This is from the Itivuttaka, and this is the only sutta which is outside of the four main Nikayas. The Itivuttaka is a collection of short little suttas, and it's a nice little history behind the Itivuttaka. Apparently, these suttas were collected by a lay woman at the time of the Buddha, and she remembered all the suttas herself, and then later on she kind of, I guess, presented them to the monks and reminded the monks of these suttas. And then this is how these particular collection of suttas came into being. And this is what one of these suttas from that collection, and this is how it goes. O monks, if people knew, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they would not eat without having given, nor would they allow the stain of stinginess to obsess them and take root in their minds. Even if it were their last morsel, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared it, if there were someone to share it with. But monks, as people do not know, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they eat without having given, and the stain of stinginess obsesses them and takes root in their minds. The Buddha is saying, telling us that it is very, very powerful. Giving generosity is very powerful. It is so powerful that, again, you would take every opportunity if you can. Whenever you eat, you should try to share it with somebody, because that is how powerful it is. So this is just a reminder of, again, the importance of this, right? Yes, and this idea that you don't allow the stain of stinginess, right? It's good to remember this. What does it feel like to be stingy? What does it feel like to be generous? I'm sure we all know what these feelings are. When you feel generous, it's kind of it's a beautiful feeling. There's a sense of sharing, a sense that you have kindness to the people around you, a sense of openness, a sense of broad-mindedness that comes with generosity. And stinginess, it feels kind of, it's obviously selfish, right? You're thinking about yourself. Your mind is narrow, your mind is contracted. There is something unpleasant about it. I don't want to share this with everybody. This is mine, right? It doesn't feel nice. And remember that feeling, and then you will start to understand why it is so important. It is so important that feeling of being generous, obviously, is much more conducive to things like metta, towards meditation, all these kind of things, because it opens up the mind, and you feel good inside, and that becomes the fuel for meditation to work. So remember that, and when you remember the feeling, then you try to avoid the stain of stinginess to obsess your mind. Right? If you see stinginess arising, you think, no, this is not right, and you try to move in a different direction, because you know this goes against the whole path. And as I also mentioned the other day, when we were looking at the very beginning of right view, remember that in the suttas it always says to be able to enter a deep state of samadhi, to be able to enter, to become a stream enter or reach one of the Aryan stages, you have to have a completely open heart, a completely open-handed. This generosity has to be absolute. There can be no holding back. No stinginess can be left behind. So this is kind of the point here. We're trying to get to this point where you just feel this sense of wanting to give, right? Wanting to share with everybody here. Where your heart opens up to all other beings. I'm sure many of you have felt that sometimes. And it's a very beautiful feeling when the kind of you feel that your heart opens up and you just want to share with everybody here. And it is necessary. If you don't get that feeling, it means you also will not be able to enter deep samadhi or attain the stages of enlightenment. This is part and parcel of the path. And then you start to understand the significance of these things. Okay. Next sutta. Worthy deeds. And I will read this fairly quickly and then comment fairly briefly on this sutta. There are these four things that lead to the obtaining of four other things that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and rarely gained in the world. With wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained, the noble disciple undertakes four worthy deeds. What for? Here, householder, is the Buddha speaking to a layperson. With wealth acquired by energetic striving, etc., righteously gained, the noble disciple makes himself happy and pleased, and properly maintains himself in happiness. He makes his parents happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his wife and children, his slaves, workers, and servants happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his friends and companions happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. This is the first case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been properly utilized and used for a worthy cause. This is about how to use whatever wealth you have accumulated in life. And the first thing which I find interesting about this is this idea that it is righteous wealth, right? You have worked for this wealth. This is wealth that you have deserved because you have lived a good life, you have worked hard. You know, this idea about the strength of your arm, the sweat of your brow, it means that you have actually exerted yourself in whatever way, in whatever profession you have, to gain this wealth. It is, you are deserving of that wealth that you have. And the interesting point here, of course, is that when you give what you feel you deserve, what is really righteously yours, then giving it to somebody else is much more powerful. It's when you give something which is righteously earned, that is the most powerful thing here. That is what he's saying here. So what that means is that if you have gained your wealth through some kind of dodgy way, perhaps through corruption or through deceit or through whatever, for fraud or whatever, then it doesn't feel as if it belongs to you in the same way. And then when you give it away to somebody else, it doesn't have the same power. Right? Generosity has much more power if it is the real belonging that is yours, that you feel that you have righteously gained for yourself. So this is interesting. Sometimes, you know, I was told a few days ago about, you know, people who kind of give gifts for dodgy reasons, right? Dodgy businessmen or whatever, or maybe I don't know who it was exactly referring to, and they kind of want to purify themselves a little bit by giving it to some monks, right, or to the Sangha, or whatever it is, and then kind of feel better about the dodgy things they did to get the wealth in the first place. But it doesn't really work, right? That's what it's saying here. If you have gained the wealth in a bad way, then the karma you are making is actually reduced as a consequence. It may, it's still good, of course, it is still a positive thing, but it is much reduced. So this idea that you're going to launder your dodgily gained money through the Sangha to then acquire merit afterwards, right? It doesn't really work. That is what he's saying here. So if you have gained your money, gained your wealth in a good way, it's a great blessing. It means you have done something which then becomes the source of even more happiness in life. And if you haven't done that, actually, it is a hindrance for you to make progress on the path. That's quite interesting, isn't it? So if you have lived a good life, you have done what is right, rejoice over that. Don't be jealous of the dodgy people who make heaps of money, because actually, they're not going to go very far on the Buddhist path as a consequence. That is what this says. So very interesting. They can still go far on the Buddhist path, but they need to change their attitude. That's basically what it means. So that's the first thing. The second thing, which of course is interesting here, is that once you have acquired the righteous wealth that you are worthy of, then the first person you make happy is yourself, right? And this is a very Buddhist idea, this idea that we look after ourselves. We don't neglect ourselves. The first person we make happy is me. And this is something that you see throughout the Buddha's teachings, this idea that we are closest to ourselves. There's nobody else that we are closer to than ourselves. So if there's one person we can make happy with a fair amount of certainty, it is ourselves. Other people we can try, we don't know what the result is, but with ourselves we always know the result. And it reminds me of that famous sutta, or other well-known sutta also found in the Kosala Sanyutta, where King Malika and Queen Malika and King Pasenadi, they have this, they talk about something, and King Pasenadi asks his queen, this is his chief queen Malika, right? He asks her, "Who do you love the most?" Right? The king asks you, you can sort of think what he's thinking. He probably wants, you know, you can sort of have an idea what the king is probably thinking. "Who do you love the most?" And I think the queen is very brave, because she doesn't say, "You, your majesty." She says, "I love myself the most." And the king goes, "What?" No, he doesn't do that. I'm making this up. And the king is very close to his wife, Malika. They're very close together, and he has a lot of respect for her. He knows that she is a very wise woman. So when she says that, he actually listens to her. And then they go together to the Buddha, and they ask him about this particular thing. And then the Buddha says, of course, that she is right. And he says, wherever he has directed his mind in the world, everywhere it is the same thing. All beings, everywhere, love themselves the most. Right? So this is kind of very important. If you understand that we are closest to ourselves, it is important that we also look after ourselves. And actually, we come on top of the list in the people to be looked after. So make yourself happy. If you have righteous wealth, righteously obtained, you have the right to look after yourself. First one, very nice message, right? Don't have to feel guilty about looking after yourself. What a wonderful message that is. And especially, I think, sometimes in the Western world, this is a very important idea, because it goes against many of the cultural ideas of the West and cultural ideas of Christianity, where you're supposed to kind of look after others first and then yourself afterwards. Actually, it's the other way around, according to Buddhism. And then, once you have done that, then you look after other people, and of course the second on the list are your parents, right? We have just talked about the parents. They are the second on the list. You make them happy and pleased. And then come all the other people who depend upon you, wife and children, or perhaps husband and children, right, if you are the wife. And then, of course, all the dependents. It tells you the slaves, the workers, and the servants. The slaves in ancient India were treated quite differently from the slaves of, for example, ancient Greece. In Europe, the slaves were often treated much more harshly, as I understand what the historical documents tell us about these things. In India, they were more like servants, but they were bound servants, bound to the household. But they weren't really treated very harshly. And you're supposed to treat them just like you treat everybody else in the family, in a sense. And also your friends and companions. And then you are, so basically, you are generous with all the people who are close to you and who also support you, I suppose. So this is number one. So let us move on to the second one here. Again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, etc., righteously gained, the noble disciple makes provisions against the losses that might arise from fire, floods, kings, thieves, and displeasing heirs. He makes himself secure against them. This is the second case of wealth that has gone to good use and used for a worthy cause. So this is just that, you know, we have to this is just common sense, right? You use some of your wealth to make sure things are secure, to make things that your thieves don't just come and steal everything. You make sure that you have a certain security. And that is again, it's this idea that we are rational. We are wise about things. We're not kind of just stupid and throw things away. And that is essentially what this is about. I think the kings in those days must have been pretty, pretty rough, right? You have kings and thieves kind of together there. I think they, I'm not sure about those kings. I think we probably were at the mercy of kings. If the king was a good king, then it was great. But if it was a kind of very greedy king, it probably was quite difficult. So, that is the second one. I won't go into too much more about that one. The third one is, again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple makes five oblations. Oblations are, again, like acts of generosity, I suppose, to relatives, guests, ancestors, the king, and the deities. This is the third case of wealth that has gone to good use for a worthy cause. So this, again, is here we are moving more into the realm of more pure generosity, right? You are generous to your relatives and to the whatever guests may be in your house or whatever it is. Then we have the ancestors again. We also do acts of merit dedicated to the ancestor, right? You do oblation to the king, just to make sure you have the king on the right side. You kind of bribe him a little bit or whatever, whatever is the meaning here. So you give a little bit to the king. I guess today that would be perhaps taxes or whatever. And then the last one is the deities. And that is a slightly curious one. I'm not sure personally exactly what that means. And I don't know if that really is a very Buddhist idea, whether that is perhaps could be. Sometimes things infiltrate a little bit in the suttas. From the local culture, whether that is part perhaps of the Brahmanical culture or Indian culture or whatever. I'm not really 100% sure if that really is a Buddhist idea or not. It only occurs in a very, very few places in the suttas, this idea of giving oblations to the deities. And as such, as I'm a bit uncertain what that might mean. It obviously does not mean that you can dedicate merit to the deities. That doesn't work. It is specifically said elsewhere. It doesn't mean that you can give anything to the deities. The deities aren't interested in human stuff, right? It's much inferior to their own things. They have much better stuff in heaven. They don't really want our things. So the only thing I can think it might mean, it's something you do more as a gesture rather than actually being something, a real act of generosity. So it's a gesture, but maybe the deities will be happy when you do a gesture towards them. That is the only thing I can really think of that it means. But it seems a little bit empty. I'm not really sure about that. That is the only thing I'm uncertain about. And it is the case, of course, that sometimes you have, you know, in some of the other suttas, you have this idea that the deities or the devas, they kind of look down on the human realm and they see if people are keeping the 8 precepts, right? And if they keep the 8 precepts, they say, hooray, look, they are keeping the 8 precepts. What's a wonderful thing that is. It means that there will be more devas in the future because people are practicing in the right way. And from that comes perhaps the idea that exists around the world in almost all cultures, and it also exists in Buddhism, this idea that the devas can sometimes guard you, right? We talk about guardian angels in the Western culture. We have the idea of devas will look after you if you have a lot of metta. This is one of the metta-nisangsa. You find this in the Metta-nisangsa Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, that the devas protect you. So there is probably something to that, that the devas may protect us, they may look after us, if you are very good people. But whether you can actually make an oblation in return, that I'm not sure about. Okay, last one of these four. Again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple establishes an uplifting offering of alms, an offering that is heavenly, resulting in happiness conducive to heaven, to those ascetics and Brahmins who refrain from intoxication and heedlessness, who are settled in patience and mildness, who tame themselves, calm themselves, and train themselves for Nibbana. This is the fourth case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been properly employed and used for a worthy cause. So this is the last one, and it is for this one specifically that it is said that it leads to a heavenly state, right? This is the kind of offering that here seems to have the most potential for driving you in a good direction to a good rebirth. And of course, the sort of people that are talked about here, ascetics and Brahmins, are anyone basically who's practicing in the right way, anyone who's kind of moving in the right direction towards Nibbana, towards Samadhi, whoever that is. Not just Buddhist, it could, for example, also be somebody who attains Samadhi, perhaps outside of Buddhist, might also be included in this. But certainly, the Sangha and even even Buddhist lay people who practice right way could be included in this particular category. Like, you know, somebody who lives the life of an Anagarika, always practicing the eight precepts, that sort of thing here. And it's interesting, this is the thing then that leads, this is where the gifts really start to lead to a heavenly rebirth. But that doesn't mean that that is the only way place gifts should be given. And this is what the sutta says. You should not give always with this idea in mind, I want to go to heaven, because then greed starts to infest your heart. You should give in all of these places. Despite the fact that one place the merit is greater, you should give across the board. And that is the kind of heart which eventually then leads you even more powerfully to the right samadhi and the right kind of rebirth in the future. Okay, I don't think I need to comment much more on that, so I will just read out the last paragraph, and then we will stop for this afternoon. These householders are the four worthy deeds that the noble disciple undertakes, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arm, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. When anyone exhausts their wealth on anything apart from these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to waste, to have been squandered, to have been used frivolously. But when anyone exhausts wealth on these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to good use, to have been properly used, to have been utilized for a worthy cause. So please don't squander your wealth. Use it in the right way, and then you are following the advice of the Buddha himself. Okay, so that is it for this afternoon, and I'll see you again this evening.